as a survival mechanism, humans desire to believe that what they're hearing is true because it makes their lives easier.
Hello and welcome to Identity Today, your go-to for what's what in all things security, digital identity and biometric tech. I'm your host, Blair Crawford. Today in the show, I'm joined by Elif Dennis, Senior Consultant at Critical Insight and current DEFCON Black Badge holder. The topic of today is social engineering and the concept of trust. I really hope you enjoy the chat.
I think it might be worthwhile to take 1 minute to discuss security.
Hi, Elif. Welcome to the show. Great to have you on today.
Yeah, it's fantastic to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation.
All right. So before we get into all the juicy stuff we're going to discuss today, can you tell us a little bit about yourself first, you know, background and a little bit about how you get into social engineering as well?
Sure, absolutely. So my name is Elif and I am professionally a social engineer. I work also in risk management and security assessments for businesses at a firm called Critical Insight, which is based in the Seattle area of Washington State in the United States. I've been there for coming on 2 years now. And previous to that, I had experience in research and market intelligence, as well as marketing and audit and compliance. So all of those skills kind of rolled up into this one crazy fun job. But what social engineering essentially is that I test businesses and their staff's capabilities when it comes to defending against social engineering attacks. And most people are familiar with the idea of social engineering from the perspective of being scammed through a phishing email or a sketchy phone call or a link that you might receive in a text message on your cell phone that leads to a malicious website or a website that's trying to capture your login credentials and passwords. And what I do is I use those skills to, as a tool in a complete security program, help our clients and their organizations to teach their staff how to defend against these social engineering attacks in the context of their everyday life, as well as their work and responsibilities while they're working for their employers.
A couple of the examples there, people will probably traditionally just think of them as phishing and the ability, for an example, click a link, steal some credentials. But what is the actual social engineering concept? What exactly is that?
What is at the core of social engineering is a person's ability to influence another person to take an action or to have a behavior as a result of their manipulation or encouragement. And that act of essentially manipulating an individual into taking that action, that is the social engineering. And that relies on a social engineer's ability to use human psychology and behavior against their target. So if they understand how to influence somebody, and the six principles of persuasion are a really great place to start if you want to learn more about the psychology of influence. These behaviors are used a lot by salespeople and people whose job it is to market and advertise to you, whether they want you to click on a link in a marketing email or purchase the used car on the lot that they want to get rid of that week. They're going to use things like scarcity and consistency and just understanding what your interests and likes and dislikes are so that they can pose as someone who is similar to you and gain your confidence. They're also going to try to use factors like their appearance and the way that they behave and emulate your behaviors and your culture and the way that you engage and speak with people because they want to seem more like you. People are more likely to trust someone that they think is more like them and who they find physically attractive in appearance. So essentially, a social engineer in the context of security, compliance, cybersecurity, that person is going to leverage those influencers trying to be more like the person that they are interacting with, if it's a physical engagement where they're actually on site in a building talking to someone and trying to get into a data center or a secured area. They're going to try to show that there is a trust that's already been built with them through using another individual or another organization. So they'll pose as a known vendor to the company, pretending to be someone that they trust from a trusted organization.
So there are competitions for what you just described to see who's the best in the game at actually being able to do that, both from a professional capacity, but I'm also imagining people who are just generally interested in whether they're good social engineers partake in this. You're the reigning DEFCON black badge holder. So for those who are not familiar, what does that mean?
DEFCON is the world's largest hacking conference. And prior to the end of the world and the pandemic, they expected around 30,000 conference attendees at each one of these conferences in Las Vegas each year. So it's a really huge conference. It is specifically for hackers and not really geared towards information security professionals. So it's for the attackers or the red team, as opposed to the defenders or the blue team. But there are a lot of blue team folks that do attend the conference to learn about new hacking techniques and to stay up to date on the latest things that they're going to have to defend against. So it's a really good mix of the security and hacking community. And there is a competition within the social engineering village at the conference called the Social Engineering Capture the Flag. And this competition is essentially a combination of research and information and intelligence gathering called OSINT, or Open Source Intelligence Gathering, coupled with a phase of the competition where they actually put you in a soundproof booth and they have you call the individuals who you found to be employees of your target company. And you have to actually elicit specific pieces of information from those individuals for points. And the person who gets the most points in their 20-minute allotted time is then the winner. So I had a few weeks to do reconnaissance and collect information on a target Fortune 500 company. And then I placed 3 calls in the span of the 20 minutes that I had to 3 different employees of that company. And I was able to elicit the most points using the flags that I gained from those people, everything from who their janitorial service is, what operating system they use on their computer, the mail client or software that they use to read their email. All of those things are worth a different amount of points. And in doing so, I managed to win that competition. And for winning that competition, DEFCON honored me with a black badge, which is essentially ultimate bragging rights. It's extremely humbling, and it's a complete and total honor to receive a black badge. Not only is it recognition for winning the competition, but you also receive lifetime access to the conference as part of your Black Badge Hall of Fame win. You get to come every year for free.
That's really cool. So what did it teach you about trust and human bias? It's not just that competition itself, but everything that you've been doing within this industry.
So I started off with social engineering skills kind of as a child, really looking at the what's in it for me side of the equation and how I could manipulate the outcome. As I got into the workforce, I started using these skills more for the purposes of marketing, advertising, research, and information gathering. And when I went to DEFCON for the first time, I found the Social Engineering Village, and it was like all of these things clicked together. And I could see that there was a path for me that gave me an opportunity to use all these skills, which are usually thought of as being pretty shady, malicious, and mean-spirited, for something greater, I think, than me. And giving businesses an opportunity to essentially fail these types of tests with no negative repercussions to their business, and reinforcing the things that they're teaching within their security programs and their security awareness training. But it's also, it's just fun as heck. I mean, there's no way to really put into words the feeling of managing to have what would be a successful attack. And it's interesting because when I started doing this, I was really in it for the thrill of achieving success from the perspective of an attacker. And the more I've done this and the more I've worked on security and compliance and doing assessments from the defender side, the more of the blue team side, the less thrill I find in the red teaming and the social engineering aspect, especially if I'm the person that's doing the security awareness training. Like, what kind of a security awareness training person am I if I go to test them and then they fail afterward? It makes me feel terrible. But just having the ability to play on both sides of the equation and to reinforce what we are teaching using the tool of phishing engagements, it's really fun because I get the buy-in of my client. They want to see how their employees are going to perform against these types of attacks. They love being my inside person in the organization and feeding me intelligence about what their coworkers are saying and if they're reporting the phishing emails and like all that kind of stuff. So it's just, it's a really fun engagement. And I think the best part is that, you know, if you fail with me, it's the best case scenario. There's no negative repercussions to the business. I never encourage anything beyond coaching for employees who fail, maybe additional training, some extra help with identifying how they're being manipulated psychologically. For example, a phishing email is going to try to elicit an emotional response from you. And typically it's going to use things like artificial time constraints, like hurry and respond now or you're losing out. So anytime you receive an email where there's that sense of urgency and it makes you feel either fearful or just anxious, and it elicits that more emotional, like knee-jerk response rather than giving you an opportunity to analytically and logically think through what's being requested of you, I 100% encourage people to just kind of take a step back and further evaluate and make a phone call maybe. What's tricky is even if you get good at defending against phishing emails, you may be not so great at defending against the phone calls. And that kind of goes back to the competition, because in the environment of the competition, you are putting that person on the spot and people are more likely to want to be helpful and to comply. And they also default to what I call trust, in that they want to trust what they're being told. As a survival mechanism, humans are, they desire to believe that what they're hearing is true because it makes their lives easier. If we were to be on, you know, maximum alert all the time and suspicious of everyone and just believing that everything we hear is a lie, it's a very difficult and stressful life to live. But there are absolutely times when that extra mile to verify whether a request is coming from a genuine or authenticated source is critical. And when we're talking about sensitive information and access to systems, credentials, things like that, taking that extra minute to challenge the requester politely is something that's going to really benefit you and, in the context of work, your organization, if you're able to protect their assets and client data, sensitive information, and areas of a building. And I think that we should all empower our staff to feel confident enough to challenge someone who's making a request who has not been completely verified and checked out. Because I think a lot of people feel like they don't want to embarrass someone. They don't want to put somebody on the spot. They don't want to challenge somebody in a position of authority, which is another one of those key six influencers. If you feel that somebody is in a position of authority over you, whether it's just that they're the IT person and it's their job, so obviously they're the expert here, or if it's somebody who's impersonating a manager, a boss, an executive, people are less likely to challenge those requests because they feel like they should just comply immediately with the authority. So to that end, we have to kind of move away from this idea that we should blindly trust people and be helpful, and that we can't challenge those requests or challenge those requesters for additional verification because it's rude or it's out of line, because it's absolutely in line with our current security considerations and risks in every organization. I don't really care what industry you're in. Security is absolutely a factor, and protecting our client and personal and employee and business data is a priority over making somebody feel bad for a minute that they have to drag out an additional form of identification or make a phone call real quick before they let you through to an area.
I want to come back to this default position of trust in a moment and how that impacts how we think about security or approach security. But one of the things I want to go back to in what you said a couple of minutes ago about the thrill that you get when, as a social engineer, when you actually complete a successful campaign. One of the things I always think interesting, and us as a security vendor have to think about when we're hiring our internal, you know, penetration testing team or hacking team, or whatever we call them, is this banner of their ethical hackers. But this idea of a thrill, how do we make sure, and I have no idea what the answer is to this, to be honest, how do you stop someone moving over to the dark side? And we always kind of ask that, like, are you still a Jedi? Or, like, does the thrill become so much? It's like, I just want to go that extra bit and actually execute, you know? So you said that. I'm keen in your opinion on that.
Absolutely. So in the beginning, I really approached social engineering as a means of using all these malicious, tricky, manipulative skills to gain that thrill in an environment where it was condoned and appreciated and approved. Over time, my mindset really shifted to trying to frame these things in a more positive way. But I still get requests from people on a daily basis on how they can get into this line of work. And typically, I can see who's on the dark side and who's looking at this from, you know, an ethical and morally good position, and what their intentions are by the questions that they ask me. And I think that when you're in a position where you're interviewing potential candidates for a red team or a penetration testing team, you're going to know or be able to gauge what that person's priorities are based on a series of questions that you can pose to them. If it's someone who is really focused on the scope and how far they can go and how deceitful they can be, and they're offering pretexts that are fear-based and scary sounding and really rely heavily on manipulation tactics like threats and that kind of stuff, then that's someone that I would kind of not want to put on my team, only because I would believe that that person may have the wrong mindset for the engagement, and that their interests are really more focused towards themselves. Whereas if they seem mindful of making sure that they're not going to give someone a negative experience or threaten someone or be malicious, and their pretexts are more ethically based, the most effective pretexts are scary and they are threatening and they leverage all of the most manipulative tactics. But there still can be incredibly effective pretexts, and typically they look like really boring HR and operations kind of related stuff. But if I hear somebody giving me more normal email for business use type scenarios, then I can see that they're considering things over and above just achieving the goal. And I will always tell a client, doing a one-time phishing exercise and leveraging those fear-based and threatening pretexts, you are always going to have people that are going to fail, and you're probably going to have a really high click-through rate. And understanding and seeing that is going to be absolutely useless to you as an organization. What really matters is how the culture of security within that organization changes over time, and teaching people how they can be psychologically manipulated so that they can identify those things in more subtle phishing emails and avoid doing things that could be, you know, not in their or the company's best interests. That's what's important. So I can teach people to identify specific types of scamming emails. We're all familiar with the most common themes, like the Nigerian prince and several other common types of phishing emails that promise money, that give you a time frame that you have to reply within or it's gone. Those are really easy for people to spot. But again, I think if you're looking to hire a team, try to evaluate what their priorities are for the test. You can tell if their priorities are really focused on their own benefit in being able to hack all the things for lack of a better term, or you can see if they have your organization's best interest in mind. Are they looking at the broader program, or are they looking at the single attack? Are they evaluating metrics that show improvement in your organization, or are they just trying to push the envelope on the scope and the allowed metrics of the engagement? Those types of things will help you weigh whether or not a team is going to be successful in bettering your security program rather than simply exposing, you know, one or two vulnerabilities or areas that you can work on to patch or improve your security awareness training around.
So just looping back and taking something you said there about training people around psychological elements of security, is that directly related then to this bias that we have or this default position of trust that we employ in our day-to-day?
Absolutely. I think along with those six principles of persuasion that I mentioned earlier, you're going to find that there are unconscious bias that all of us have. We may be aware or unaware of these things. And I will speak 100% generally about these unconscious bias. And I acknowledge that there are absolutely people out there that will have the opposite, completely different, or no bias in specific areas. It depends a lot on your culture, your heritage, how you were raised, the environment you're raised in, the demographics and the population that you're raised around, schooling, all these things impact each of our bias. But most, if not all people, have some sort of unconscious bias. In our modern culture, it is quite typical for people to underestimate someone who looks like me. And in fact, I call being underestimated my superpower, because if I can leverage an empathetic pretext, I will make myself seem weaker and in need of help or just a hot mess. And typically people will think, oh, well, she's harmless. You know, there's nothing that could possibly be bad that this woman could do if I let her into this building. Looks like she spilled coffee all over herself. Poor thing. Let me let her into this bathroom. And then, you know, from the bathroom, I can pivot into most of the employee areas of the building. Whereas if a man who's similar in appearance, but, you know, more imposing, say, shows up and asks for the same type of concession, they may scrutinize his requests a little bit further. And this is just because as people, we develop perceptions of other classes and types and identifiers within the population of people around us. And it's not politically correct. And I would love it if we lived in a world where that was not an issue and we all saw each other as 100% equals, but that's just simply not the reality. So as far as just the unconscious bias that we have, it makes it so that in most environments, I have an opportunity to not only train individuals in how to avoid being manipulated through these psychological influencers, but I also have an opportunity to educate them regarding their own bias. I have bias. You have bias. Everyone has bias. And it's not that you're doing anything wrong. It's not that you have a negative perception of people. Most people want to be helpful, and they're more likely to help someone that looks like they are struggling. And it's more acceptable for a woman to put herself in a position where she admits she's struggling. So for example, most men don't like to ask for directions because they don't like to admit that they don't know where they're going. Whereas women are more likely to ask for directions because we're okay typically being in a position where we can admit that we don't know where we are and we need help getting where we're going. It's just like I tell my kids, there's no adult that's going to ask a child for help. No adult needs your help. So if there is an adult that's asking you for help and guidance and trying to figure out where something is, or just come with them for a second to help move a box, that is not a request that you should entertain. That should send all the red flags and every alarm in your head should be going off. So there are certain things that, I mean, I tell them too. I'm like, I had one of my kids ask me, well, run with me because we were late for school. Run with me. I said, no, I can't run on the school campus. And they're like, well, why not? I said, because when adults run, it makes other people nervous. And it's super true. Like, you can see kids running across a playground or running across a school and nobody thinks anything of it. Kids are running. They always run. That's just something that kids do. But if you see a full-grown adult running at full tilt through a school, you're going to be concerned. And so these are all things that we've learned, behaviors and socially acceptable things that contribute to our bias. And as a social engineer, I can leverage those things to make you feel or perceive me in a certain way. And if I'm able to compromise a company, which honestly on the inside, I really hope I'm not. I hope they stop me. But if they don't, it's an opportunity for them to learn that regardless of what I look like, sound like, behave like, say what's going on with me presently, they absolutely have to, without exception, hold to their policies and procedures and check thoroughly before they admit access or grant access in a system or give information.
Just digging into those biases for a second, you've mentioned before in one of our earlier chats that as a general rule, women make better social engineers than men.
So, and this really lights some people up, the idea that women are better social engineers than men. And I know that a lot of the most famous social engineers, like the pilot from the movie Catch Me If You Can, he was obviously a man. And there are some magnificent con artists who were men. So the idea that women are better social engineers, I think most people perceive that as, you know, women are more approachable or aesthetically pleasing to look at, and that it's easy for us to get out of things like parking tickets and getting pulled over for speeding. But what I focus on with regards to women being better social engineers is the idea that, generally speaking, women are more empathetic to other people. We are better at putting our own egos aside and holding our judgment of others and really opening up and making friends with people on a very emotional and genuinely authentic level. When women have conversations, we are focused more on creating genuine relationships. Whereas, and again, I put the disclaimer that this is all very generally speaking, and there absolutely are men out there who are tremendously empathetic. But most men look at a conversation from the perspective of asserting either their authority or expertise and coming to a conclusion that either benefits them or achieves the goal of the conversation, rather than building that rapport and that relationship with the other person. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying it's the wrong way to go about things. We are just different in the way that we approach relationships and communication with other humans. And through that, women are typically better as far as being aware of the other person's feelings and how they're perceiving them and reading those interactions and those social cues so that we can navigate the conversation in real time and adjust our strategy if we're trying to reach a goal at the end of that conversation where we want to gain access to a building. So with women, we're more keenly aware of the environmental factors and influences that could be changing a person's perception of us, as well as the environment that we're in. And that allows us to pivot better in the moment. We can also default to those empathetic pretexts and kind of ask for help in a way that most people will be responsive to. And that's kind of what I feel makes women better social engineers, is our ability to both evaluate the risk level in the environment that we're in, like, how hard am I pushing this person? Should I back off? And just really gauging how they're responding to us, as well as taking into consideration other environmental factors and things like that. But we're also more geared towards that building of rapport and building trust with the individual rather than just meeting the objective of the outcome of the conversation. That said, I do know, after watching several contestants in the social engineering capture the flag competition, for example, that men will often succeed more often with an authority-based pretext over the phone. So for example, one of the competitors used a pretext where they pretended to be the company's IT person, said that there were reports of network problems, and they were asking whether or not they could ask a few questions of the individual on the other side of the phone. That person just accepted that who they were talking to was their IT support department, that person had the authority in the conversation to ask these questions, and immediately complied with the requests. This call was performed by the social engineer, Chris Kirsch, who won the competition that year. And after the competition, he decided he would record a reenactment of that call, and he put it on YouTube. So the following year, somebody decided, you know, this is the winning call from the previous year. I'm just going to do this, because if this won the previous year, it could absolutely win this year. And so they copied that pretext, and it was a more petite and younger sounding woman. And the unconscious bias of the person on the other end of the phone, who was also a woman, but older and more experienced, put her in a position of losing that authority almost immediately. So she wasn't able to back up that authority-based pretext against her target, who was also a woman, and became very suspicious very quickly. And when she started questioning this younger female social engineer, her whole pretext kind of fell apart. And she was trying to scramble and like dodge challenging questions and the objections she was getting. And she really didn't get anywhere very quickly at all. So while I think women are generally better social engineers over the phone, and especially in a physical test or assessment where you're actually on site in a building, I will say that there are challenges on both sides. And if you have a woman as your social engineer and a woman as your target, especially in a physical situation, the woman would be much more likely to get challenged by another woman, because most women see other women as a threat.
So do you think that some of what you're talking about is learned behavior, but some of it are you seeing as like an innate difference, like at a biological level?
I think absolutely it's learned behavior. And as a parent, I recognize this even in myself. And I'm very lucky. I had my three boys before I had my daughter. So there are actually several studies on this and how parents will put more limitations in place for their female children, believing that they are not as physically capable. And this is something that we have learned through the way that our society markets things to us. What we've been told growing up is the way that you treat a, you know, female child versus a male child. There's all these boundaries that are put in place. And they said that in this study, and I'm afraid I don't have the actual reference material in front of me, but in this study, I read that parents who allowed their children to play on a playground didn't think that their daughters could jump as far or off as tall of a structure or be as physically capable as parents who had boy or male children play on the same playground. And I grew up with brothers, and I let my boys test all the boundaries. I let them jump off of every and anything within, you know, the realm of, are they going to cause permanent damage to themselves? Of course, being a consideration. But, you know, I let them really fully test their physical boundaries, because as children, very generally speaking, boys are a lot more physical, and that's how they express themselves. And with my daughter, I thought, this kid is going to be, you know, very emotional. She's going to be much calmer. She'll probably be interested in things like books and, you know, quieter activities. And boy, was I wrong. She is the craziest kid of all four of them. And it's because she's being raised in this little wolf pack of brothers. And I have not given her any boundaries. I have not told her she can't do anything they can do. And she has just gone full tilt headlong into this, you know, fully active type of mentality where she thinks she can literally do anything. And it's fantastic to watch. And I'm so glad that I had the experience that I had prior to having her, because I think that the way I was raised would have impacted my limitations and my expectations for what she was capable of, you know, as a toddler, just based on, you know, what TV shows and movies and our parents and school and friends and other people taught us we were capable of as kids. So it's something that I believe is learned. It's supported by our culture, the media, all these outside influencers, our parents, how they were raised, what they believe were allowed, capable, and what's acceptable behavior-wise. I think that it's something that really is unavoidable in any culture, but I do believe that we are making strides in our generation, and I'm sure the next generation will cover more ground in starting to break down those bias and really even the playing field, so to speak.
So that means what we're targeting is that, as a general rule, women aren't necessarily better engineers because we'll fix some of the societal issues that are telling people to do this or that or something else.
Yeah, I've always said that, you know, you can't know for a fact that a woman or a man or any other underrepresented group would be more successful in an engagement. I have scripted phone calls. I have, you know, killed myself in hours of prep trying to figure out what's this person going to do if I do this or if I do that? How would I pivot from here? And I go into the conversation thinking I have mapped out every route this could possibly take. And I know exactly what to do at every single juncture. You know, if they go this way, I'm going to go that way. They say this, I'll say that. And then I get into the actual situation and it's all for naught. Nothing goes according to plan. There's no way that I could have, you know, anticipated that this was going to happen or that was going to happen. And I look at the world really through a lens of people just being people and trying to capture, you know, the cultural stuff, of course, and outside influencers in the environment over trying to base pretexts and the way that I approach people purely on things like gender and other ethnicity, nationality, and demographic type descriptors, because you can't possibly know what any human has been through in their life and what their experiences are. You can't count on a person absolutely taking an action based on an assumption that you've made that's based on essentially what amounts to bias. So it's really important to not make your pretext, the way that you approach people, so dependent on those factors. You really kind of have to make yourself more empathetic and truly suspend your judgment of the other person and your own ego and try to genuinely build rapport and earn their trust. And that makes being a social engineer somewhat exhausting, because you do have to genuinely build relationships in some cases, especially if you're looking at longer term engagements and things like that. But I will share that it absolutely makes you a better communicator in every area of your life if you understand those things and focus on not using the manipulative tactics, but going more towards the trust, building rapport, leadership, and influence from a more positive perspective.
So just the last thing I want to ask you then, organizations which are concerned about this at the moment, or whether they've just, after listening to this podcast, are thinking, maybe not given that as much consideration as we could have or should have, what would your top tips be? And where do you think they should go and start to learn more about social engineering? And for everyone listening, we'll provide some links as well off the back of this.
Yeah, I know that this problem isn't going away. There are technical controls that we can use to defend against social engineering attacks reaching our human staff. Things like email filtering and multi-factor authentication. Those things are all great technical controls that can help to prevent social engineering. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to expanding the awareness of our teams, demonstrating to our staff how this can impact them, not just in the workplace, but in their own personal lives. And I think if people understand how social engineering can impact their lives in a negative way, whether they get scammed or phished or tricked into, you know, applying for a job that doesn't exist or sending a scammer money in a Facebook group where they're promised to, you know, purchase a product that doesn't exist or something like that. Once our staff understand how this impacts them at a personal level and how to defend against the actual psychology that's being used to manipulate them rather than just, you know, learning 10 or 15 different popular attacks and how to spot them, understanding that psychology and understanding how, if they feel emotionally triggered, that they should ask for further validation and how to mitigate those types of attacks through understanding of the psychology, that training is essential. And then how you measure the success of your training in your total security program is having that regular phishing and testing, because to put it bluntly, some of us, myself included, only seem to learn the hard way. So you can put all of your staff through, you know, hours of on-site or remote or computer-based learning training and still not achieve the result that you want to achieve without the testing. And I'm not encouraging companies to test their staff with scary pretexts or using things that I would deem pretty unethical, like promising bonuses or, you know, something that's important and in the news and using that as a trigger to get people to click links. You really want to look at this from the perspective of education and supporting and empowering your employees to have everything they need to defend against the phishing email rather than how you can trick them. So those would be my top points. Do the security awareness training, have all the technical controls that you can afford that are within your budget for your organization to help prevent those things from ever reaching your employees, and then test that training as part of a total security program. And do that regularly over time, whether it's monthly or quarterly or annually, that would be up to you and your business priorities. But measuring the metrics over time is by far the most important element there.
Thank you very much, Ali. It's been fantastic to speak with you. And I'm sure we will speak to you on the show again.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. This has been my pleasure. So thank you again for having me. And I hope that everybody has learned something new and that I haven't just terrified everyone.
Not at all. See you again.
All right. Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week on Identity Today with me, Blair Crawford. I'd like to say a big thank you to our guest, Lee, as well as a big thank you to you, our listeners. If you want to know more about what we do at Daltrey, head to daltrey.com.